From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. First of all, a little hello to new Coast to Coast insider born to Adam and Beth, little Simon. Welcome to the world, Simon. If you're into baseball, All-Star Game, American League 2, National League 1, and later on tonight, zombies. Here's what's happening. Authorities in Southeast Texas have launched an investigation after city workers found razor blades embedded in playground equipment at two parks. What sicko would do that? Officials in Huntsville, located about 70 miles north of Houston, found four blades on two sides at the Emancipation and Botchter Mill Roads in those parks. Investigators say a heating device is being used to melt portions of the plastic sides, and then razor blades are then inserted into the melted surface. Jeez. 38-year-old man died after apparently jumping from the top of Kilauea volcano in Hawaii. The Hawaiian Tribune reports that the man's body was found Sunday near the bottom of the Kilauea caldera, an area that is not currently erupting there. The United States has shot down a has shot down a simulated incoming intermediate-range ballistic missile similar to the one launched by North Korea last week. The test of the state-of-the-art THAAD missile defense system over the Pacific Ocean comes amid heightened concerns about the nuclear threat from North Korea. Dr. Jerome Corsi with us. Jerry, we're getting ready for something, aren't we?
I think so, George. I think it's getting hotter by the moment, and I'm confident the Trump administration has looked through the military options. I continue to caution that a war with North Korea is a really bad idea and dangerous, even for a limited military strike. North Korea has the capability of attacking with all of their artillery South Korea and killing thousands of people. But the point is, I think the Trump administration has reached the point where a limited strike to get the attention of China and to put the issue on the attention of the world, I think that option is getting to be increasingly considered in the White House.
I think so, too. I would just hope that there'd be some kind of coup within North Korea to get him out.
Well, George, that'd be very positive if it would happen, but I just don't know that that's going to be the case. I mean, maybe there'd be a SEAL attack that would be targeted to Kim Jong-un. I don't know. But the point is, this is a situation where the President of the United States, in protecting the people of the United States with a missile from North Korea that could hit Alaska, just simply can't ignore this situation forever. And I think Donald Trump has put that to Putin and Russia very clearly, and a limited strike will probably be the next option if no more sanctions work or no more international intervention takes place.
Dr. Jerome Corsi received his PhD from Harvard University in political science and now writes for Infowars.com. Jerry, thank you so much. A New Brunswick Canadian man said he was not trying to steal anyone's thunder when he gave a speech at his daughter's wedding, and then he was struck by lightning. Luckily, he was unharmed, but what a strange circumstance that was. Many scientists say it's abundantly clear that the Earth is entering its sixth mass extinction event, meaning that three-quarters of all species could disappear in the coming centuries. They say it's terrifying since humans are contributing to this shift. What else is going on in the world of science and space? Let's check in with our science advisor and historian Robert Zimmerman. Robert, it's been a while. What's new?
Oh, there's lots of stuff. I've been posting like crazy on Behind the Black about a whole range of things, planetary research, science research. China started a 200-day simulated self-sufficient space station experiment. They put, just this week, they put four students into a facility on the ground. They're going to live there for 200 days. What's interesting about this is they say it's self-sufficient, which means they're trying to make a closed environment, everything working. Now, you think this is a space station experiment for an interplanetary ship to go to Mars or whatever. But what's interesting is they said, as an aside almost, that they're going to try living for a period of time without any sunlight on this to see if the facility could work without sunlight, to see if they could survive without sunlight. There's only one place you'd build anything where you might have to go a period of time without sunlight, and that's the moon. where, you know, you have a 14-day night and a 14-day day. And so they didn't say so, but I read this and said, okay, they are testing the technology and engineering for building a lunar base here. And the Chinese are very serious about this. You know, they had a failed launch about a week ago of their Long March 5 rocket. That's the big rocket that they want to use to build their space station and go to the planets and go to the moon and so forth. So they got to fix that. But this is a very aggressive space program, and you should be. We should all be prepared for soon Chinese astronauts on the moon. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Is their technology today as good as the technology we had in 69 when we went to the moon?
Better. If you're comparing it to 1969, I mean, they can't do specific things we did in 69. They still cannot land a human on the moon, but that's a matter of time. In terms of actual, you know, point-by-point technology, of course it's better. We've got a half a century of technology advancement that they can take advantage of. They designed their manned ship and their station based upon Russia's designs for Mir, but then significantly upgraded those designs. Their manned craft is basically a Soyuz craft, significantly upgraded. And so what they've done is they've taken previous technology by others, they stole stuff from us as well, and they have improved it significantly. So yes, they are definitely advanced and a challenge. And we're basically looking at a new Cold War here, because they are still a government, government-run, top-down, Soviet-style space program. Military-civilian mixed, while we are moving back to American concepts of freedom and competition and capitalism. And so we're going to actually see a Cold War play out here all over again between private enterprise and communism.
Here we go. Robert's website, BehindTheBlack.com. All those news inserts, they're linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. Well, they say generosity makes people happier. Even if they are only a little generous, people who act solely out of self-interest are less happy. Merely promising to be more generous is enough to trigger a change in our brains that makes us happier, according to neuroeconomists in a recent study. Up next, an incredible story from an investigative journalist who has dealt with all kinds of aspects of the human mind, selling body parts and organs, trying to push yourself to the limits. Scott Carney is next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Scott Carney with us, investigative journalist, anthropologist, has worked in some of the most dangerous and unlikely corners of the world. Wait till you hear these stories. Currently, senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism, and in 2016-17 was the Scripps Fellow at the Center for Environmental Journalism in Boulder, Colorado. Carney was a contributing editor at Wired for 5 years. In 2010, he won the Payne Award for Ethics in Journalism for a story called Meet the Parents, which tracked an international kidnapping to adoption ring, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Scott, amazing work you've been doing. I mean, absolutely amazing.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, George. I'm really excited to be here.
And you've written a number of books, and we're gonna talk about all your works, because each one is a separate story in itself. But tell me, how did you get involved in covering these kinds of stories as a journalist? What was it that hit you the first time that got you to start covering these?
Well, it started in sort of an unusual way. I was a graduate student in anthropology, you know, just finishing up my PhD, when I decided that I sort of wanted to quit the program and try something else. And I was probably 24 or so, 25. And I decided to take a job leading an abroad program for American college students in India, where we traveled to all the holy sites in the north, to Delhi, to Varanasi, which is the holy city of death in Hinduism, and then on to Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha attained enlightenment about 2,800 years ago. And I've been working in India for years. I speak Hindi. I know the country very, very well. And what I was excited to do at this time was to teach my students, you know, the wonder of being in such a foreign place.
Mm-hmm.
And the highlight of the program, and the story's a little bit long, but I think it's worth it.
Well, you're on with me for 2 hours. We got all night, practically.
I love it. So, you know, the highlight of this program was to do this 7-day silent meditation retreat in the Tibetan tradition, where we would meditate on enlightenment, on nirvana, on looking for sort of bliss, and, you know, these really positive.
Now, is it like a sweat lodge, Scott?
It's not. It's like a temple, really.
All right.
And we're sitting in a room, you know, there's a big golden Buddha statue in the front. The person who was teaching us was actually Swiss-German. She was a nun wearing robes. And, you know, I had been meditating for years. But I was, you know, I wasn't a teacher of this. So in this point, I was sort of a student along with the other 12 students in my program. And we sit there and we meditate on, you know, on what the nature of enlightenment is. And while we do that, we also contemplate what it means to die one day, this sort of inevitable thing that's going to happen.
In this meditative state?
Yeah. There were some meditations on death, and there were some meditations on just realizing that life is impermanent, that we're all going that direction at some point. And, you know, Buddhism has a very, you know, positive take on this, is that, you know, we're all part of this big cycle, if you will. And, well, one of my students, her name's Emily O'Connor. She's the prettiest, brightest, sort of most like driven of the whole group.
Mm-hmm.
She was a person who, you know, probably got straight A's in everything she ever did her whole life. Now, at the end of the retreat, you know, we were silent this whole time, and I saw her just sitting up perfectly straight, you know, and just really adhering to the lessons.
A great student.
A really great student.
Yeah.
And on the last day of the retreat, she climbed up to the roof of the retreat center, tied a blindfold around her head, and jumped off.
Oh, my God.
And
she killed herself.
She killed herself. And I, the director of this program, you know, 20-something old me, was probably about 5 feet away from where she landed. And when a student walked into my room at about 3 in the morning saying, oh, my God, Emily is dead. She's outside. She's not breathing. I run out there, and I really am sort of lost at the moment. And then, you know, I see her. There's blood everywhere. The other director on the program was performing CPR. And I suddenly realized that I'm not just in charge of taking these students through India, but in the case of their death, I'm responsible for, you know, bringing her back.
God, and you got to tell the parents, and oh, horrible.
It's the worst thing. And so I call the director of the program back at in New York, and I sort of relay the news, and, you know, the night sort of like unravels into this sort of chaotic mess. The other director brings her corpse to the local hospital at the Gaya Medical College, and I am suddenly dealing with the police who are coming, and I'm the only guy who speaks Hindi in the whole group, so I'm the unnatural liaison here. And we find her journal and we read it, and here's the crazy thing. The last lines in the journal say, I am a bodhisattva.
What does that mean?
Well, in Tibetan Buddhism, the idea of bodhisattva is essentially an enlightened being, something who, in particular, it's an enlightened being who gets to the point of nirvana and decides, instead of winking out of existence, to instead help every other sentient being in the universe achieve enlightenment. Essentially, it's an angel. It's this divine being.
Does she think she's immortal when she writes that?
Well, what she had thought, and, you know, I read the whole journal. There's a lot more to what I'm than just that I'm a bodhisattva. But what she had said was essentially all she needed to do was leave her body to become this enlightened being.
Oh.
And she had these great realizations on the retreat that she was something special. And as a person who'd just been meditating here, right? And we're meditating on bliss, we're meditating on enlightenment, we're meditating on these things that are wonderful, right? There's nothing wrong with enlightenment, right? But to realize suddenly that someone could have this realization and end up in such a dark place, right, where this sort of insanity can come in,
mm-hmm.
and where she takes her life not out of depression, but out of bliss. And so, now, I'm really worried about all the other students on the program, and we there's just suddenly a lot for me to do.
Yes.
You know, we're the India in this area can get up to 110 degrees pretty easily. We're packing her with ice. We're having to usher her through autopsy. And, you know, in the next stage of this story, in the next 3 days when I'm bringing her back home, I'm sitting literally next to her body for 3 days, seeing this person who was so live and vibrant suddenly transform into not much more than meat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's this moment where the special person that we are in our bodies goes away, and then it's the stuff that's left. And this moment, this sort of three-day moment where I'm bringing her body back to America, it actually has an inspiring thing for every piece of work that I've done since then. And the first realization that I had, right, was this, how the body becomes just a thing that other people deal with. You know, the day before, she's one of my students. I'm trying to usher her through life and get her into adulthood safely, right? And then when she's dead, she's suddenly like a piece of property, and people are bargaining over pieces of her, like literally. The police want literal parts of her brain and her liver and her heart and these various things, and the insurance company wants money out of it. And all of a sudden, the material reality of the body becomes very apparent to me. And, you know, since I had then made my home in India as well, I suddenly became aware of the economic value of a body, and this led me in this sort of twisted investigative journalism route to start looking at how the world values the human body. And all of a sudden I discover, you know, hundreds of people buying and selling human body parts in India, whether it's skeletons or bones or kidneys. And I'm looking at this, you know, suddenly $1 billion market.
Oh, now, was this the basis of two of your books, A Death on Diamond Mountain and The Red Market?
Yeah, in a way, it's the basis of all three of my books. You know, the first book is The Red Market, and it's called On the Trail of the World's Organ Brokers, Bone Thieves, Blood Farmers, and Child Traffickers. You know, pretty dark stuff.
That
right?
is dark. Absolutely.
It started with this moment where I realized that the body is a commodity, and I end up, and I'm sure we'll go into this over the course of our conversation, but I ended up looking at all the criminal networks that buy and sell body parts. But at the same time that I'm doing that really hardcore investigative journalism, I'm also thinking in the back of my mind, what is it that drove this wonderful woman to take her own life while pursuing divine goals, right? By wanting to become enlightened, by wanting to become essentially an angel.
Well, she, and I'm going to guess here, Scott, that she did not think she was ending her spiritual life at all, that she was going to evolve and move on. She knew she was going to end her physical life, but it didn't seem to bother her.
Exactly, right? She knew, I mean, it's very clear reading her journal, she knew that she was going to be reborn into another better incarnation, and that it was actually her body holding her back. And, the things that, what I realized is that this was not an isolated case whatsoever, right? This desire for divine ends is actually when you become dis... But
you're saying that there have been others who have done this?
Yes, I am. I actually started collecting journals of people who died on meditation retreats. I collected, I think, about a dozen accounts of people who go into 7-day or longer meditation retreats and end up either going insane or ended up taking their own life. And, you know, I even found this condition, and this is crazy, you know, in New Delhi, there's a hospital there that admits 100 patients a year with something called India syndrome.
What is that?
It's the India syndrome is this people who come to India, usually Americans, usually Westerners, with ideas of enlightenment or ideas of like spiritual levitating gurus or whatever. And those ideas in their mind take sort of hold of them, and they get to India and they suddenly see it, and they suddenly realize that they are an incarnation of Vishnu or Shiva or whatever. And you know, these people end up going crazy. And, you know, I found accounts of an Irish guy named Jonathan Spolin, who ended up, you know, probably disappearing down a river in a town called Rishikesh, you know, dying. Another guy named Ryan Chambers, same thing. And there were just lots of them. And India syndrome is just another cognitive, another thing called Jerusalem syndrome, where people go to Jerusalem and discover that they're Jesus all of a sudden.
Hold on for a second, Scott. We're at the break. I want to come back, and let's also talk about this 38-year-old Ian Thorson. Tell us about him, and then we'll get into your most current work, which is What Doesn't Kill Us. That's another strange story. We'll be back. We are back with Scott Carney. His website is his name, scottcarney.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We are talking about some incredible cases that he has investigated. Several of his books include, of course, A Death on Diamond Mountain, The Red Market. We'll get into that a little more. And What Doesn't Kill Us, that's his latest work, which we'll talk about tonight as well. Scott, this case of Ian Thorson, who died from dehydration on a remote Arizona mountaintop, is this a similar situation?
Yes, exactly. Like, I had been investigating instances of people who sort of went insane on meditation retreats. And I had come across Ian's story while writing an article for Details magazine, where he and this woman named Lama Christy McNally had ended up following this sort of charismatic Tibetan guru named Michael Roach. So not a Tibetan from Tibet, but a white guy with long hair and robe,
mm-hmm.
who preached a couple different things. One, that you could meditate your way to riches, and another, you could meditate your way to becoming an angel, that you could meditate your way into superpowers, levitation, walking through walls, all sorts of things like that.
Geez.
And what they had done is went on it's a crazy story, actually. So
they're all weird, Scott.
They're all really weird. It's a long and twisting tale. This one involves a stabbing, a tantric sex events, and ultimately a 3-year silent meditation retreat in the desert. Where
a 3-year retreat?
3-year silent retreat, not just a retreat, a silent retreat.
God.
Where Ian Thorson and Christy McNally. Christy McNally is his lover, his wife, and a woman who had been deemed a goddess by this group. And she is also the former lover and wife of Michael Roach, who is this guru. So we have this weird love triangle going on. And Christy McNally and Ian Thorson went into the desert for 3 years. Things got really weird, and they ended up meditating in a cave outside of their retreat center until Ian Thorson got sick and started getting dehydrated. He had diarrhea.
How many people were doing this at any given time, Scott?
I believe this retreat, I'd have to check the numbers, but I think it was about 50 people in the
50
in the
people.
Deserts.
Okay.
And it might have been 30, but, you know, more than you would expect for such a series.
Sure. Now, was law enforcement aware of these people out there doing these things? I guess they're not doing anything illegal, are they?
Yeah. Oh, law enforcement is very aware. And actually, in this county in Arizona, they've had lots of conflicts between sort of fringe religious groups and the police. One famous shootout in the mid-80s between a black evangelical Christian church and sort of these more conservative, Joseph Arpaio sort of situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there was a fear that this group could go that direction as well, that they might sort of take up guns and do really crazy things. And they sort of proved it a little bit when Christy McNally on this retreat came out very briefly to give a lesson of what she had learned in her first year of silence. And she mentioned that she inhabited and invited the goddess Kali into her meditation. And Kali is the Hindu goddess of death and destruction, the goddess you'd pray to before a war when you want to absolutely destroy your enemies. And she invited this goddess into her meditation and then ended up stabbing Ian Thorson in the ribs with a kitchen knife.
Jeez.
In a ritualized combat, which is also a way for them to play out sort of their sort of issues in their own marriage.
And I assume she killed him by doing that, right?
No. He survived. He was he was given medical treatment by another person in the retreat who was actually a doctor, and then they sort of covered this up. But when she gave this teaching publicly, a police report was eventually filed, and the group got very unstable briefly because, you know, stabbing people during your search for enlightenment.
Yeah, nice.
Right, you know, right? And so this is what actually instigated them being sort of kicked out of the retreat and going off into the mountains alone into a cave with just a few loyal followers occasionally giving them supplies. And in these rustic conditions, Ian Thorson got dysentery. And he started getting very sick, you know, as you do.
You dehydrate.
To replenish, right. And Lama Christie, Lama is sort of a title, means sort of similar to guru. It means sort of revered teacher. And they had given her this name because they thought she was a goddess. And Lama Christie, instead of calling the police, because she had a cell phone and one of those personal locator beacons, you know, mm-hmm. press a button and
right.
the helicopters come in and pick you up.
Sure.
Instead of helping him with the button, she decided to heal him with her special healing powers of her meditation that they'd been practicing. And the first day she was meditating over him, and you know, he gets worse. And then the second day she's still doing it, and he's just getting worse. He's turning, I think, dark purple, her journal entries later
said. God.
And then on the third day he was not breathing anymore, and she finally decided she'd press the button. He may have been dead already. And they come in and they find it, and then Ian has died here on this mountain.
Huh.
But the crazy thing is, he may have been okay with that. He may have, like my student, Emily, he may have, you know...
just wanted to leave his body.
And seen this as a process of becoming an angel.
Scott, are these people from the get-go a little whacked out?
I would say these particular people... that I'm talking about at Diamond Mountain, are perhaps predisposed to some sort of magical thinking sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may have some, you know, in some degrees, isn't life a pre-existing condition, right? Isn't everything we do sort of a pre-existing condition?
Sure.
But I think what it really is this fascination, this sort of American fascination with work hard and you'll get what you dream of, right? This is sort of the American religion, right? Work hard at anything and then you can become an astronaut, you can become a president, you can become a levitating yogi maybe. And we have this romanticization of Eastern philosophy where we look at India, we look at Tibet, we look at China, and we think that while there might be some poverty and some craziness over there, somewhere in the Himalayas maybe, there's people who have these eccentric, spiritual, almost Yoda-like powers. And I think that there's a real draw in American society to want these things, to want, you know, if you're able to study hard enough and just dedicate yourself hard enough, you can achieve these things. And when you have a teacher, like this man named Michael Roach, the head of Diamond Mountain, saying that you can do that, that you can get rich through meditating, and that you can get superpowers through meditating, people buy it and people want it, and we want it so much that mixture between sort of that American drive and this sort of the mystery of the East becomes a very potent concoction to make people sort of lose touch with reality. And when you give into that, you can go all the way down this sort of dangerous path. And I see the same process that happened with Ian Thorson under the direction of this sort of suspect guru as the same thing that my student Emily did to herself when she was just reading these scriptures and hearing these sort of sacred chants. And there's whole genres of literature, starting in the probably 1400s and, you know, gets a real boost in the 1800s that really just play up this very mystical Eastern magical power.
Is this all still continuing?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Jeez. I mean, this only happened a few years ago that Ian died.
So there's still people coming into these programs and these meditation sessions and all over the planet still.
Certainly. And, you know, I do want to make a caveat here and not say that all meditation and all Buddhism or all Hinduism is crazy. It's not, right? It's something about that fanaticism that we get when we search for mystical experiences.
But I'm wondering if prolonged meditation does something to the mind.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and see, this is what neuroscientists talk about, neuroplasticity. And this is a moment where your brain is able to form new neural connections. And we know that meditation increases the plasticity of the brain. And usually we consider that a good thing, because what happens is you know, when you're in a plastic state, you can learn things better. You learn languages better. You learn new skills better. And that's one of the reasons why we say meditation is a really good tool. But in that plastic state, you're also susceptible to various sorts of suggestion. You're susceptible to, you know, suspicious, cultish claims. You're susceptible to your own inner craziness. Because, you know, if you meditate, and you don't have that much experience, and you sit and you just watch your thoughts, and necessarily have a huge amount of experience in this, you'll notice that time will speed up and it'll slow down, the walls will move, and, you know, the light, the quality and the texture of the light will change. And these are very ordinary experiences in meditation. But for somebody who's never experienced that before, they could look at that as a window into a whole nother world, right? They could look at that as evidence that they have superpowers. And then once you start feeling you have superpowers, then you can start acting on that. And if you're not directed in a proper way and sort of pull back from that, or you don't find a way to pull back from that inside yourself, it can end up in this sort of terrifying and horrible place. Well,
truly a remarkable story. Scott, let's talk a little bit about the Red Market. Next hour, we'll talk about your latest work, What Doesn't Kill Us, and we'll take calls next hour with you as well. Now, the Red Market, this organ broker world that's out there, this is big business, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's billions of dollars of business.
Oh, my God.
And we all are part of it, right? And so the way I found out about it, right, is I was living in Chennai, India, which is on the sort of right north of Sri Lanka, on the right side of the Indian coast. And a village right next door to where I was living, you know, maybe 5 miles away, every woman there had sold her kidney to local hospitals, those hospitals would sell the kidneys to wealthy Indian patients and occasionally foreigners who would sell.
How much would they sell their kidney for?
Well, it's a sad story. You know, they'll sell it for, the broker will tell them, they'll give them $2,000, which is ludicrously low, but they'll only pay them actually half the money, because they'll pay them half up front and half after, and the broker skips town.
And they take the kidney and leave.
Take the kidney, once you got the flesh, you know.
Oh, my God. So they sell a kidney for $1,000, but to them, $1,000 is like $100,000 here, isn't it?
Well, it's more. Yeah, for sure it's more. 60 times 1,000. So about $60,000.
I guess, you know, you can function on one kidney if the other one doesn't go out on you, right?
You can, right? And that is totally possible. But the thing is that aftercare isn't necessarily great. And also, should we be looking at poor people as the supply for flesh for rich people?
No, it's like a farm, isn't it?
Exactly. And in fact, they called these towns where it was happening Kidney Vakum, which means Kidneyville.
What organs are generally sold or taken?
Well, in this case, I was looking at kidneys. From live people. And you could do it by kidnapping people, but it's often easier just to pay them really low rates.
Okay, but are they kidnapping people to take livers and things like that?
Rarely. It does happen, but it's definitely rarer than a kidney, because you can function after giving up your kidney. It does occur, but it's most prevalent, that sort of thing, in China, where you'll have these prisoners, political prisoners usually, of the Falun Gong.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of this group.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
They're sort of like they study a sort of a something that looks like Qigong or Kung Fu, essentially. Or yoga. And the Chinese government doesn't like them, and they arrest them liberally. And what was happening, and probably still is happening, is these political prisoners are also thought to be very healthy, very good shape. So the Chinese government will actually tissue type them, taking blood samples of the Falun Gong. And then when somebody needs a kidney, they will run the match through their blood central database and then execute these people on demand.
And take the kidney. Now, how much does a kidney sell for on the market to the rich?
Well, how much are you willing to pay?
It comes down to that.
It's like a used car. It's like, you know, and when your life is on the line, I mean, honestly, it's not so dissimilar to the American healthcare system. When you have a broken leg, how much are you willing to pay? It's like whatever you
whatever you can afford, I guess.
Right. And it is whatever you can afford. But essentially, you could probably get in a good old-fashioned, you know, certified used kidney for between $14,000 and $120,000.
Unbelievable. What about hearts? Do they take hearts from people?
In China, you can get a heart, yeah.
You can get a heart in China.
And
the government supports this in China?
The government supports it. They run it. They don't support it. They're the ones profiting on it directly.
Now, why don't these issues come up when the president of China meets with President Trump? Why aren't they talking about stuff like that?
Good question. They have a lot of other stuff to talk about, lots of other human rights violations.
I mean, I've got to assume that that guy that we saw with President Trump, the president of China, fully knows about this and obviously endorses it. Is that an accurate assumption?
Well, does he endorse it is a question that I can't answer that for him.
Maybe he can't stop it.
Because what I will say is that every few years, the Chinese government releases a statement that says something to the effect of, oh, organ harvesting of prisoners? Yeah, we stopped that like 2 years ago. But they release this statement every few years. So,
yeah, it keeps continuing. Just, what about eyes? Can you transplant an eyeball?
You can, but you know, let me tell you about the weirdest one that I came
across.
Right. Was the market for human skeletons. Where
human skeletons?
Human skeletons is so in Calcutta. Well, in the world, right? If you want a doctor to learn how to, you know, learn osteology or learn the how a human skeleton is connected, you can study plastic skeletons. But really, the gold standard is a real skeleton. And you would think that they get skeletons when they do gross anatomy. You know, their opening course where they dissect the body initially, but actually that doesn't provide a great skeleton because you sort of cut it up.
Well, what are they going to do with the skeleton, though, once they have it?
Well, to study bones. I mean, every doctor...
Can't they use a plastic skeleton that's a perfect a replica? Do they have to have the real deal?
They can. It's just not as good. But here's what happened is until about 1984, every doctor in the world, and especially in the United States, but in the world to a slightly lesser degree, got with their introductory medical textbooks a full human skeleton, and they bought it for $300, and it was just sort of issued to them at their medical bookstore.
Yeah,
and so I think about every doctor, and we're talking going back to the 1700s, really, would get a skeleton. These skeletons had to come from somewhere. And what I discovered in sort of this big feature for Wired magazine was that these skeletons were all coming from Calcutta. And at the height of the trade, and Calcutta was exporting 60,000 skeletons a year, which means that if you died in Calcutta...
You're going to be a skeleton.
You were sold. You were directly sold to doctors in America, doctors in Russia, doctors
Unbelievable.
All over the world. And so it was made illegal in 1984 because there were riots associated with child skeletons being exported. And people were caught with I think it was like three burlap sacks full of child skeletons. And child skeletons were more valuable because they're rarer. And the assumption was that they were killing children for skeletons.
And they might have been.
They very, very easily could have
been. Jeez, God, what work. Was it difficult for you to, we're coming up to the break, but real quickly, was it difficult to get the information for the books?
It was very hard, right? This is not easy stuff. It's dealing with a lot of very serious criminals, a lot of dangerous people.
I would think so. You got to be careful. Scott, we're going to come back in a moment. I want to talk about your latest work called What Doesn't Kill Us. This is a strange one, too, and we'll take some phone calls from folks next on Coast to Coast AM.